When I got out of MLM, I was overwhelmed by shame, regret, guilt, and loneliness. But sharing my story has helped free me up, and I want to invite you to do the same, either publicly or anonymously, as a catalyst for your healing. The From Huns to Humans podcast is a proud supporter of the hashtag I Got Out movement. Learn more and find resources at igotout.org.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey hon, it's me, Danielle. I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor, and I'm here to talk about all the ways multi-level marketing and mental health do not mix. It is important to know that this podcast is not meant to diagnose or for treatment. This podcast is based off of personal experiences and opinions, and is meant to educate and entertain. Now sit back and start healing with me on this episode of From Huns to Humans. Hello, everyone. I just wanted to come in here and provide a content warning for this episode. We do talk about suicidal ideation and thoughts and plans, not in detail, but just a heads up. But also, this episode is themed with eating disorder recovery. So if either of those topics are hard, and sexual assault. So if any of those topics are not for you today, please feel free to skip this episode or come back later when you're feeling up to it. I hope that you have a fabulous day and enjoy the episode.
Okay, round two.
Yay! Hi!
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of From Huns to Humans. I am here with my friend Dana Altman. Funny story, not so funny. I'm having a lot of technical difficulties today. So if my sound sounds different, I don't have my normal mic. And also we are recording on Anchor instead of Zoom today, which has already given us some problems. We were like just about to like really get into the meat and potatoes of Dana's story when all of a sudden it just stopped working. So hopefully this works and this airs and this is what goes out there. But otherwise, yes. This episode might end up happening another day. So, Dana, hi, how are you? So for everyone, Dana doesn't have an MLM story, which is classic on this podcast. However, she does have a really relatable mental health journey and is also the founder of Fake It Till You Make It. She's an author and lots of other really cool things that I can't remember what you said in your last intro. So I'll let you reintroduce yourself.
Oh, no worries. Yes. No, you got it. Author. I also like to think of myself. Well, I am. I'm an entrepreneur and mental health advocate.
Yes. Yes. We love real legit entrepreneurs here on this podcast. So
yes, absolutely. So I was just sharing in our first take that I have been on this mental health journey and struggling with my own mental health forever, I feel like, but I didn't really have the language or the words to share that until I went to college. And in college, things kind of, my mental health, it became too difficult to ignore. I think beforehand, growing up in elementary school and middle school, I had a lot of perfectionistic tendencies. I really felt like if I looked put together on the outside, that maybe that was true, or maybe that would make me appear perfect. And for me, perfect always meant like enough or lovable enough, good enough.
Right. And I think that's really, what you said in the last take was that it was part of the community. And I think that's really true based off of the people that I know that you grew up with. Like, yes. I mean, because I know quite a few people that you you were in your circle. So like, I did feel like there was a lot of like, I didn't recognize it at the time because I was so young, but I do, now that you've said that, I see a lot of like people that really were like trying to be perfect all of the time.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. And I talk about this with my parents sometimes because they really feel like we chose this town because it had so many resources. Like, why is this difficult? But it's a different struggles, I guess, in
right.
that capacity. So yeah, really always wanting to do that. This really also coincided with, I absolutely loved musical theater. That was like my thing. Acting, singing, dancing. And there was a lot, I think, of reinforcement in that area too. Like, and who's gonna want to see a show that's not perfect? I remember my sister and I did theater, community theater, and like our director was like, this is an amateur hour, but like now as adults we're like, it literally was though. Like, theater. but anyway, so I think like hearing those messages coupled with also my mom having an eating disorder my entire life and not really doing anything to help it, even admit it, and all of the things that I think have been really important to me in my recovery. And so growing up in that environment, like, of course, when I was going to break at some point. And for me, I think it was the transition and the change into college. You know, I went to summer camp, but otherwise I never had any experience away from like my support system, my family. And I was diagnosed with anxiety, depression, and an eating disorder. And at first, being diagnosed with an eating disorder was really confusing. And I think for a couple of reasons. The first was because this was what I was doing like my entire life. I didn't realize that like the diets that I had been put on when I was in middle school was like not something that you were supposed to do. like actually like loving your body and like nourishing your body was something that was like in other people's vocabulary and in things that, yeah, that like, that I just never experienced. I also thought that if you had an eating disorder, that meant you had to be like quote unquote thin. And I don't think that I ever felt like that, but I also think that's so dangerous because I think that that is a reason that so many people who struggle with eating disorders don't seek help because of their body dysmorphia or what they think like an eating disorder looks like, when really eating disorders we know come in every body type, every lifestyle, like every identity background.
Right.
So I think that's become a big part of my message too. I think even in my own recovery, like, and being in a recovered body, I think a lot of times people are like, you had an eating disorder. I'm like, yeah. And I still struggle. Like, it doesn't, you can't see that. It's like a mental illness, you know?
Right.
Know. It's interesting that like, that I don't know if it's like the media or just like our culture or both, that it feels like people can have a right to like comment on bodies or like make those judgments, which is really upsetting because I know how damaging that can be. But anyway, little side tangent. anyway, I made it through my freshman year of college, but that summer I ended up going into eating disorder treatment for 5 weeks. And I really felt like showing up was going to fix everything. Like, I thought that if I signed up for this program, I was going every day, then like there was just going to be some magic result at the end of the 5 weeks. And no, they were asking me to do really hard things, like uncover my thoughts and sit with the depressed feeling, sit with not feeling enough, sitting with anxiety, asking me about my family. And it was tough because I did a day program. So I went every day during the week, kind of like a job, like 9 to 5. And on the weekend, you know, growing up in this household that didn't understand recovery and I don't think still does, would tell me like, oh my gosh, this, you know, you can cheat around this meal plan that I would bring home. Like, this is too much food. And I think that was really hard. I also thought that going and showing up, as I said, was going to fix everything, but I also thought I was going to feel better. And I really didn't. I felt worse. And I think that kind of perpetuated this depression that I was feeling so yeah. much so that I was really struggling with suicidal thoughts and wanting to end my life, like creating plans. And I ended up going to a different program after the eating disorder program that was more focused on depression and suicidality at McLean Hospital. You know, we're so lucky to live in Massachusetts with the best psychiatric hospital literally in the world, like down the street, which is amazing. And I had a really great experience at McLean. The program that I went to, it was for adolescents, and I was 18, so I was like right at the edge. But I felt like that was such a huge part of what made that program successful for me, was because I felt like a role model. Like, all, being a role model has always been something that's been really important to me. I don't know if it's because like I have a younger sister, or I felt like I've lacked that in my life. So I think having the opportunity to be like, hey, I'm the oldest, like I'm gonna actually show my peers, or these young people, like what it's like to recover. That was such a huge motivator. I also got like put on medication that I felt was really helpful. I started to learn skills and tools. And it was during this time that my sister and I started my kind of first entrepreneurial venture. Well, that's not true. I've been an entrepreneur since I was 8. My first real entrepreneurial venture, which was The Beautiful Project. And
I remember that.
Yes, yes. The Beautiful Project was, we created this organization where there were kind of a couple of focuses. One of them being talking about like beauty and deconstructing media beauty standards through using YouTube and having people tell their stories, which is so interesting because that was like such a big deal then. Like, I mean, YouTube was a thing, but it's just funny because I don't feel like a lot of people were using YouTube at the time, but we were. We also made bracelets and sold them to fund the National Eating Disorders Association. And as much as that experience being an entrepreneur and an advocate gave me so much purpose in my recovery and made me feel so like alive, it also was really detrimental because I think that I had this idea that because I created this organization and I was like being interviewed for like, remember Her Campus? It's definitely a thing still, but I remember that was a big deal.
I don't remember that. Oh, but
okay.
Yeah.
Like a college publication.
Okay.
Yeah. Just like, I guess like getting this like media attention, I really felt like, okay, I can't, like, I'm recovered. Like, I'm the poster child of like it being over. And I think that that has been something that I've really dismantled in my current advocacy. I think like one of the things that makes me successful in what I'm doing now is that my honesty and how like this is just a journey that is never, that is I'm going to be on for the rest of my life, and I'm okay with that. I really am. But at the time I couldn't access that. I felt like a failure that I was like trying to heal myself and telling people like you can recover, when really like I was slipping back into my eating disorder behaviors and I was super depressed. And I ended up going into this like locked psychiatric unit over like our holiday break, which was very difficult. It was very different from the experience I had over the summer because I was with adults. And I'm not saying that to like scare anyone. I always want to say like those units, like they exist for a reason and I needed to be there, believe me. But it was not the same experience. It was not like the groups and like the crafts and I don't know, like healing that way. It was like a lot of just safety, like people like watching you shower and like being constantly watched, like not having a phone, not having shoes, like all of like really scary for me. And I can remember after that, like going back to school my sophomore year, second semester, and sitting in a school reentry meeting with my parents and like the dean and saying like things are going to be different now, and just back to that perfection needing to look good on the outside. But that only lasted like a week and a half. I ended up leaving school in late January for a medical leave after a really kind of serious moment of suicidal ideation. And I just remember not wanting to be in pain anymore. I don't know if I necessarily like wanted to die, but I just didn't see any other way out. And I took a medical leave, and that was so hard. I think I had always been someone who followed like a path and really felt like I was just doing everything that everyone else was doing and having Facebook, like really the only social media at the time. I think Instagram like existed, but I wasn't using it. But seeing on Facebook, like all my friends at parties, and like I could not move off the couch. And I remember like one of my parents had to stay home with me at all times. Like I could never be alone. And that just made me feel like such a burden to my family, and just so much shame and guilt. My mom actually forced me into dance classes, which ended up being like the best thing that I could have done. But I'll never forget like the first day that she literally like dragged me into the car. But that ended up being so healing. I mean, I love dance. Like that was always such a big part of my life. You do too, right?
Yeah, I dance now.
And that really, really helped. And that like kind of got me through a couple of months. And then finally, you know, the medical leave plan was to go into this other program at McLean Hospital that was for like women in particular who struggled with everything I was struggling with, basically. And I always really talk about this time in my life, like this hospital admission, as my turning point. And it's interesting because it definitely was and is, but now it's been like almost 10 years since then. And so there's just like, there have been other ups and downs and other turning points. But at this point in my life and my mental health journey, this was really the turning point for me. And I think for a couple reasons. The Hill Center is where I was, is based on a type of therapy called DBT, or dialectical behavioral therapy. And it was created by a woman who struggled herself and came up with these different modules and tools. And I think that that's what I was lacking. Like I never learned coping skills, and like not to like totally blame my parents, but no, I mean, I don't think like I didn't learn them in school either. Like I did not have coping skills. You know what I mean?
There's such a switch now. And I think that the schools are focusing more on social emotional health.
I'm so glad. Yeah.
But that was not a thing when we were in school, like at all.
Not at all. And so I think having like tools was really empowering for me. And then lastly, I was paired with a case manager when I was in the program for about a month. And she ended up becoming my therapist after the program, and still is actually. So we've been working together for 10 plus years, which is amazing. And
that is amazing.
I'm very, very grateful for her. A lot of people ask me, like, her name's Dina, which is funny, like mine, a little bit different, but a lot of people ask me, like, what was different about that relationship. And I think a couple of things. On the one hand, I think I went to therapy looking for someone to give me the answers. And she never did that. And I hated that at first. I was like, I am sitting here waiting for you to tell me what to do. But she really encouraged me to like find that within myself. And that was really hard because she also had a little bit of like a tough edge in that back then. Now, not anymore. But at the time, that was really hard. But also, I think that she really offered this maternal energy for like toward me. And it's hard because my mom and I are very close. We still are. We always have been. And I love her like more than anything. But given her eating disorder and her own kind of limitations because of it, there's always been a part of that like maternal piece that I just don't think that like I get. And I think that I found that in Dina. And that has been very healing for me. And it's even complicated. It's hard because it's like a therapeutic relationship, but there's more to that for us. And it also, like, we've also been working together for a decade. So like, of course, like I've seen her grow up, like she has kids now. I'm like, I was the first, you know, she has two kids of her own and is married. Like, I don't know. I've known her longer than her husband. Like there's a lot of, there's a lot of aspects that made that and continue to make that so helpful and for me. But that was huge. And then at the end of that experience, I decided to transfer schools. And that really wasn't something that I had even thought about at first. I really was imagining that I went to Providence College for my first 2 years. I would go back to Providence College. But I just couldn't imagine ever going back and like feeling different. Like I just was, there was such a so much of my mental health journey and my experience with mental illness was tied to that school, because that's when things really fell apart. And so I just needed a fresh start. So I ended up going to Northeastern, and Northeastern was just like the perfect fit for me. And I am so appreciative that I got a college experience that was kind of normal after having some really tough times at PC. And I think Northeastern was great for a couple of reasons. I mean, I remember when I got to Northeastern, I was like applying for all these student groups that were like had application processes, and I got into all of them, which was just a stark difference, because at Providence College, I also applied to for everything and I never got it. And so that was just like a great example, like, okay, this is like a good fit for me. This is the right school, which was really affirming, I think. And I also really liked that people at Northeastern did more than 4 years of school, because we had the co-op program, which is 6 months in the field, not taking classes. So most students did 5 years. And I think I felt really embarrassed about, feeling as if I needed to stay longer than like my class at Providence College. So it was nice that everyone's kind of on their own path and journey.
Yes.
So that was great. My fourth year at Northeastern, things felt really normal. Again, I felt very, I felt like a normal college kid. And one thing that I really wanted to do when I started, like when I was applying to college and high school, was study abroad. That was really important to me. And, but I didn't think I could do like six months abroad. Like that didn't feel attainable. And so, I decided with Dina and with my family that I would do Birthright. And so Birthright allows people who are Jewish to go to Israel for free for 10 days. And it's for like young adults, 18 to 26. I think with COVID, they've expanded the age, because a lot of people who wanted to do Birthright, you know, during the height of the pandemic weren't able to. But at the time when I was doing it, it was 18 to 26. And I went to Israel, and unfortunately, while I was there, I was sexually assaulted by someone I was traveling with. And that really just like, I felt like that just pulled me back to the beginning. I felt like everything that I had worked for was just like vanished, like right in front of my eyes. And it was really hard. It still is, you know, it's been a long time now. That was 2013, but it still sits with you, you know? And I think when I talk about it now, I have quite a few things to say. The first is, if you're listening to this, and I hope you are never in this position, but if you are in a position where a friend comes to you and tells you that they've experienced something like this, I think the best advice that I could give you is just to listen and believe them. And unfortunately for me, I feel like my first points of contact were very doubtful and critical. And I think that just really caused a lot of shame, and I think really prolonged my healing process. Like, I really feel like if my first contacts after that were more affirming or like believed me and wanted to help me, that would have been different. And like, granted, that is not their fault. Like, that is like the perpetrator's fault. But I think that, like, I don't know, I've been in a lot of situations like my life now where people ask me like, what would you have wanted? And that is my answer.
I think that that's such a big thing too, that, you know, especially for people that know both parties, like they get really weird and they don't know how to handle the situation and they don't realize how detrimental it is to the survivor.
Right.
And it's just absolutely heartbreaking to like see that happen. Because unfortunately I see that a lot, and I see a lot of people who will never come forward, and I'll probably be the only person that they ever tell.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
totally. And I think that like, I think just as a general, like society, like we would rather, you know, protect, like say that like the woman is like lying or like saying, not just women, there are a lot, every gender identity survivor, but I guess like speaking for myself, like I feel like it was a lot easier for people to just like want to think that like it wasn't the case.
Right. And I think people don't realize how rare it actually is that somebody's making these things up. Like, like we know how often like these things are like not believed. It's so hard to come forward. It's so hard to ask for help in general, never mind in a situation where like we know that society has been kind of programmed to not believe you.
Yeah.
So exactly. it's just so frustrating.
Yes. Right. Thank you for that, Val. I completely agree. And so I think yet again, what was so helpful for me was this call to do something, call to be that role model or advocate. And so I started my second organization at this time, and it was really focused on dismantling rape culture and being able to talk about about like stereotypes and weight and the culture around like everything we're talking about. I remember I would walk around Boston with a whiteboard and I would ask people to like correct a statement that we say when it comes to like surviving sexual, like let me think of a good example, like someone saying like we hooked up before, like that is not a reason to say like that. You can't assume consent in that capacity. So anyway, I was able to kind of go around Boston and really talk to different people, take photos, start a photo blog. I also started a fashion show at Northeastern. It's kind of been like my legacy where I got a ton of donated clothing, both from stores like retail stores, but also from people in my life, and the clothing was modeled down the Northeastern runway and then all donated to domestic violence and rape crisis shelters in Massachusetts. And that really I think helped heal me because I didn't feel like I had to hide. Granted, I didn't really make this aspect of my story public until a couple of years after Northeastern, but even without saying like this happened to me, it was very helpful to know that I was supporting other people, which is very, which is part of who I am, I think, in a lot of ways. And then finally, a year later in 2015, I graduated from college, which I always say, like, I've done a lot of cool things in my life and I'm very proud of a lot of what I've accomplished. But I think like graduating from college will always be something that I am so proud of because there were so many moments and days and weeks and months that I never thought that that was going to be a possibility for me. So being able to, to be that was like unreal. It was amazing. It's so much so that I think during my time at Northeastern, one thing that really kept me motivated was this idea that I was going to go back and help people in like the social work field, like help young people who struggle like I did. I always had my sights set on McLean because I knew how helpful that was for me. And it just felt really meaningful to go back and be work there. And I applied so many times and I got a job at McLean. And I remember on my first day, it was like a benefits training. And in my head, I was like, sign me up. I'm going to be here till retirement. Like, this is my dream. Like, I'm doing all the 401k things I can. Like, I'm going to be here forever. And obviously, you know, spoiler alert, that was not the case. I did have a great 2 years there. I think that I learned so much about everything. Like, I learned so much about the hospital system. I learned so much about myself. I learned that I love more macro level community change versus individual change. But don't get me wrong, like the relationships that I built with the people like the clients at McLean, I mean, I will treasure those forever. But I think that there's always just been a part of me that has loved and really, like, my soul is set on fire when I'm working on something big, like a campaign. And so I ended up going back to grad school at Northeastern to study public health, which is interesting because I like didn't even know what public health was, I feel like, 2 years prior. But when it was explained to me that I could go to grad school and then eventually get paid to do what I was doing for fun, I was like, okay, yes, public health it is.
Yes.
Yeah. So after, and I guess I usually kind of like skip over the public health years, like my master's degree program, but I guess it's important, like when I'm telling my story, because I guess like the most important takeaway from that time was, for me anyway, it was very interesting because I thought that I had really overcome a lot of like my perfectionistic tendencies when it came to school. Like this idea that I would get a grade on a piece of paper would tell me my worth. Like I thought I was past that, but yeah. Definitely that kind of came up again for me when I was in school and I was like, oh my gosh, like, am I a B? You know, not even being able to like hang on to my own worth and value. And that was hard. I think that really kind of showed me a blind spot in my healing in some capacity. But I think another really important part of the kind of my grad school years is I was diagnosed with OCD. And so for a long time, I kind of thought that my anxiety was not just anxiety, but it was like more of a generalized anxiety disorder. And I had a psychiatrist that my parents found for me when I was really struggling at Providence College. And it's hard because he was like, and still is kind of seen as like the best of the best, and you know his prices definitely made that him seem like that too. And you know, he was great for me at the time, but I went to him saying like, you know, I think I have OCD, like a lot of the ways my anxiety is manifesting, like I don't think that this is just generalized anxiety disorder. And he was really not supportive of that, and it was really hard for me to fire him. Like I never imagined like firing like someone who was helping me, but I had a lot of shame around that relationship. So I was able to find a new psychiatrist who kind of evaluated me for OCD, listened to my concerns, and was able to start medication, and I have an OCD therapist now. So that's kind of like more of a new element of my journey, on my mental health journey, but it's not, I guess, new in the sense that I have words for it, not new in the sense that like I've been struggling with this for so long.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen the, like, I think it's a meme or something, there something online where they talk about, you know, it's better to know that you're a zebra than to think you're a weird horse.
Oh, I like that. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, you thought you were a weird horse when you were being told constantly that you just had generalized anxiety is no joke either. Anyone that has that, it is hard.
Yeah.
But thinking you have generalized anxiety disorder when you really have OCD is like a totally different ball game.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yes, I love that. That's exactly how I felt. I think that having the words really has changed things for me. And it's definitely something I still struggle with and am learning to live with. But having like appropriate medication and like treatment is huge. So I graduated from public health school and I went to work at a nonprofit in Lynn at Girls Inc. And oh my gosh, I loved Girls Inc. I will always have such a special place in my heart for that organization. Girls Inc. is an organization that inspires all girls to be strong, smart, and bold. And it was just, I don't know. I look back at that time and I just like, oh, I just loved it. I really felt like I was able to use like what I was learning in public health school because I was working on a grant, but also able to create such amazing relationships with these high school girls. And now, and then there's a couple in particular that I still am in touch with, and now they're in college. And I'm like, oh my God, I remember when we were in eighth grade.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
Yes, no, it's so special. Like those relationships just mean the world to me. And I ended up leaving Girls Inc. And working at another nonprofit. And afterwards, but I think that there was always just this part of me that in the background, I was telling my story, speaking, or creating Bake It Till You Make It, which I can talk a little bit more about in a second. But it was all like the dream was always just to do that full time. And unfortunately, it took kind of a tough work environment to push me there, I guess. it kind of, the place that I was working before, it just wasn't a good fit anymore for me. And for like a lot of different reasons, but it really affected my mental health. And I think it was almost like I was forced into taking this leap, and I'm so grateful that I did. There are a couple other like contributing factors to that too, but let's start with Bake It Till You Make It. So in 2017, I was in grad school and I was really struggling with my depression. And on top of all of that, I got into a car accident, and it was my fault, and it was awful. And I didn't have a car for a couple weeks, and I was living at home with my parents, and all I had was the kitchen and baking. And that is when I realized kind of this healing power of cooking and baking, not only just that it was like fun, but also because I felt like it was really easy to invite people over to bake and like talk about depression. Not easy, but like easy.
Yeah.
And that just one day I just kind of had this idea to create a cookbook where people could share their mental health stories and recipes that are important to their journey. And then I would put it together, throw in some resource pages. And I've always dreamed of being an author. I've always loved writing. I remember like going into Barnes and Noble as a kid and being like, my book's going to be on the shelf one day. And so, in 2019, I did it. I did the thing. I
became a writer.
And I have, in 2022, I now have 4 books in the world. So I have my original mental health cookbook. There's a second edition, but then during the beginning of the pandemic, I wrote kind of my memoir. It felt like something I've always wanted to do, and I'm sure I'll write another one. But it also felt like I was 28 and, you know, I just turned 30, but it felt like a good kind of wrap up of the past 28 years. And that was really special. And then I just came out with a poetry cookbook in August. Poetry's always been something that I really loved, but never felt confident in. I actually took a poetry class with my favorite poet ever during the pandemic. It was virtual, and I think getting their feedback really like made me feel like, oh my god, like, I don't know if you know Andrea Gibson.
I don't. The name sounds really familiar though. Like, they're, I feel like, amazing. I do, but that sounds amazing. That sounds really cool. Like, I would never even think to like look for a class with like an author that you like, you know,
oh,
what
my,
I mean,
gosh. Yes, I mean, getting Andrea's feedback, I was like, okay, maybe I can do this. Like, I don't know, I think that was so special to me because their poetry has helped me so much. But anyway, so that's kind of Bake It Till You Make It in the book form. But I also do events. Oh, Danielle, you should totally come. Every December, I have a Nailed It event where we kind of pretend that this place in Boston is the Nailed It stage on Netflix, where like I have like a decorating competition.
And, oh my god!
Stories. Yeah, I'll send you the details.
Yes. Oh my god, that sounds so cool. When is it?
December 4th. Anyone who's listening in the Boston area, maybe I can send you the details. You can like link in the.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely.
So it's like an afternoon of decorating, but also people share their mental health stories, and I have resources. So that's a really cool kind of sacred event of Bake It Till You Make It. And then I started really taking my public speaking seriously. I was enjoying it so much. My public speaking is not any old public speaking. I do a cooking demonstration while I tell the story that I just shared with you. And I think throughout my time with Bake It Till You Make It and in my like the stage of my life where I've really taken my entrepreneurial career so seriously, it's been hard because I think I've come across a lot of people who don't get it, I guess. They don't really understand like what I'm talking about. They think it's like cutesy and like for kids, which, you know, is fine. I mean, hey, like everyone has mental health. Like if this helps a young person, like that is totally fine. But I'm talking more, they're like, oh, this is like adorable. Like, no, actually, like I'm trying to help people, you know.
Like anyone.
Yes, exactly. So I want always to find that validation and that that like self, that like worth inside myself. But you know, it helps when you have external validation too. And I think the biggest external validator for me in my in like this journey so far was getting accepted as a young mental health leader and going to the White House in May. That was amazing.
Yeah, that was cool.
I think that to know like that I was one of the 30, like the other 29 people. Oh my God. I'm looking at their profiles, reading about them. I'm like, do I belong here? And it's also really interesting because every other person also felt that way. And so, hey, imposter syndrome, or yeah. That's what I'd say. But yeah, I think like having like literally sitting on stage, talking to the Surgeon General and the First Lady and Selena Gomez about Bake It Till You Make It, like, you know, that like, it was put on by MTV and the Biden-Harris administration. And just like that validation, that chance just really helped me take myself seriously in a way that I don't think I had yet. And yeah. It's still hard because I don't know. Sometimes it's easy to just like think like, oh, you know, it was just, they felt bad for me. Like, you know, all the lies I tell myself, like, so I'm working on it. You know, I'm working on really believing in the work that I do in a way that is like powerful. On most days I do, but on the other days I'm like, what am I doing? Like, I don't know. I think I said this in the beginning. Something that's been really helpful about the community that I've created, I think anyway, or it has been for me, is the honesty that I am portraying. Like, this is my mental health journey is one that I will be on for the rest of my life. And it's not always going to be easy. And it's not always going to be at the White House. You know, that was an incredible moment. But there's a lot of work still to be done, which kind of leads me to this current moment on November 11th. That was a lot. So I hope it was helpful.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes. I mean, it's just so... I mean, as I told you, like, the reason that I brought you on here is because yeah. I have so many people that come in here and they tell me these like very brave stories about how they went into MLM and ended up really coming out not only financially ruined, but also with some pretty serious mental health issues, including eating disorders. And I know that that's a big part of your journey. And I was like, yeah. I need you to come on because it's the holidays. Everyone needs your cookbook.
Oh yes.
And it's just so important to know that there are resources out there. And also, you built this from the ground up. You are a true entrepreneur.
Thank you.
You aren't somebody that ordered a starter kit online and yes. then claimed to be a CEO. So like, that's so cool. And we love to see it. So I'm just so proud of you. And like, I know that like we're acquaintances from afar, but I've always like watched you and like cheered you on from my phone screen.
Likewise. Oh my God.
I remember when you came out with those, what it says heel on it, right?
Oh, the
shirt.
Oh, yeah.
That's my favorite shirt. I still wear it.
That makes me so happy.
Like, if you could come out with another line of those, like, okay. I don't know, like the font, it just looks so cool.
Yes. A reboot?
Hell yeah. Yeah, you should reboot that shirt.
Okay.
Maybe you can come up with a new word to come on it. I don't know what it would be.
That's a really cool idea. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Oh, you should come out with shirts that say bake it on it. Oh, wait, that might make people think of marijuana. I don't know if that's what.
Okay, very true. Yeah. There was like an article that I wrote called like Half Baked, and my dad was like, no, that was not a good idea. but anyway.
Not quite the same message.
Yes, but definitely some type of shirt. Yeah, no, thank you so much. That means a lot. I think I love, obviously, like being able to share my story, not only to hopefully inspire and help anyone listening to remind them that like they are not alone in absolutely any capacity. And I also, it's always nice to kind of hear myself share it a little bit too, because I think like I'm just me and like here are today's problems, but like you know, I need to give myself some credit. So this was really helpful for me as well. I
absolutely. I mean, and that's part of the reason that so it's kind of interesting. Like, we have some like parallels here in our stories.
Yeah.
Because I started this podcast because I didn't want to fall back into MLM.
Yeah.
And I was like trying so hard to like deconstruct all of like the mind control and everything that went into that.
Yeah.
So I like, you know, doing like this public service to try and, you know, help yourself, but also help others at the same time is like so powerful to me. Like it's helped me so much. I've seen it help you so much.
Yeah.
So that's just so cool. So now are you full time?
I'm a full time entrepreneur.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
We love to see it. Well,
yes.
So can you tell the people where they can find you and what links I will be providing in the show notes?
Yes, absolutely. So my website is bakeittillyoumakeit.co. So not .com, but it's just like bake it till you make it. And then I think the best way to like connect is through Instagram. So either just my name, Dana Altman, very lucky to get that handle, or Bake It Till You Make It LLC. They're both like linked together anyway in like the bios, but that is usually where people come to find me first. Or on my website, like there's an opportunity to, there's like the ability to send me a message. I absolutely love connecting and hearing other people's stories. Like that is such an honor to me to be able to sit with and like bear witness to other stories, just like you were saying, Danielle. And so that those two things. And then I also, trying to think. Yeah, those are like the best. I have a Pinterest, I have TikTok, but it's all Bake It Till You Make It LLC. But I would say I'm most consistent on Instagram and then the website. Also, if you type my name into Amazon, so just Dana Altman, you'll get my profile, which has all of my books. But you can also look at the books on my website. And then I guess, yeah, the final plug is for Nailed It. So December 4th, it's in Somerville, Massachusetts. It's an afternoon of baking, 2:30 to 4, decorating, mental health resources. It's $20, but you get to take a lot of the food home with you too. So the tickets are on Eventbrite. So I'll send that to you, Danielle, too.
Oh, that's so cool. Yes, I love that. So typically my final question is, what is your anti-MLM why? Let's change it up a little bit for you.
Yes.
I mean, other than the fact that we don't want you to join an MLM because you don't need one. So let me give you a little bit of context between that.
Okay.
So when we were in MLM, they would tell us that we needed to have a why that made you cry. So like why you're doing this, and people would be like, I'm doing it to give my kids a better life.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like that type of thing. And then like you get all emotional, but like really the why was because we wanted to make money.
Got it. Okay.
Or wanted friends. Those are really the two boiled down parts of going in. But anyways, so now we kind of flipped it to take power back and make it like our anti-MLM why. So what is your mental health why? Like, why do you share this journey with people? Why are you so vulnerable? Why is it so important to you?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think it's really, kind of where we started, this idea of like no one talking about it and like knowing how isolating and lonely it is to struggle with your mental health. So my why is to provide that source of light, inspiration, and visibility to those who aren't able to see that, you know, that they're not alone, as cheesy as that sounds, or that like there's nothing wrong with them, you know, that it's okay. You can struggle with your mental health and live a very full life. I think I'm a good example of that. So my why is really to inspire and empower living with mental illness. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so, so, so much. I am so glad that we got to do this. And especially, like I said, before the holidays, people are anxious about food and all of those things. And I think that we need to be reminded that it's okay to eat. It's okay to eat things that have sugar in them. It's okay to eat all of the things. There are no bad foods.
Yes. Love it. 100%. Yes, definitely. All foods have nutritional value. That's been like another mantra of mine. Like, you know, they have different properties, but they all do something. So,
right.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. I love that. Yeah. I like that reword too, of all foods have nutritional value, because that's kind of been one of the things that I've been working on right now too, is like, okay, well, this has more nutrients, this has less nutrients, and it's okay to have both. But then also, you know, like taking, like, even when you say more or less nutrients, sometimes that just comes back to bad and good.
Good, right, exactly.
Like this binary, where it's not a binary, like it's fluid. And sometimes having a brownie is going to be helpful for you. Like if you really want a brownie, like you should have the brownie, because part of your soul needs it.
Yes, definitely. I mean, that comes down to like mental health is part of health, and that's gonna help you in that moment. If that's something that you want, then like, why deprive yourself? So I'm all about that. That's right. Awesome.
Love it. All right, everyone, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time. Bye. Hey, huns, I just wanted to take a second to tell you guys about Acorn. And no, this is not a sponsored ad. Acorn is a robo-investing account that I've been using to manage my money since I've started my own small business. I honestly had no idea what I was doing in regards to saving for the future, but knew I needed to start somewhere and thought this was a great way to get the ball rolling. I really like the interactive graphics and watching what's going on with my money. If this is something that you feel interested in, feel free to click the link in my bio to start your own Acorn account, and we'll both get $5 added in our accounts for our investing future. Happy savings!